Blog Talk Radio.
Bye.
Hey there, this is Randy Goldberg, welcoming you to the Science of Light show, and want to invite callers, feel free to call in. It's 760-542-4345 is the call-in number, and and there's also a chat room. You can type questions if you want to do that. And tonight I'm just having a book group. I'm just running in from the Ewing Society here in Washington, D.C. And it's a long, ongoing course that's gone on for several years. We started out the course on the archetype of tragedy, and we started out with on the Greek tragedies, and then did Shakespeare tragedies, and then we did European plays and American plays, and now we're doing some novels, and we were just having a class on Arundhati Roy's book, The Gods of Small Things, which is an amazing book and really breathtaking. I lived 2 years in Calcutta, India. I was studying yoga and meditation and living in a yoga ashram, yoga center, and it was interesting to get that perspective. A lot of the people who read the book were so devastated and found it so depressing, but having lived in India, you get used to the shocking nature of particularly, you know, the economic violence there is really horrific. And, it's such a rich and ancient culture with so many layers and so much beauty mixed in. It's really a country of contrasts. And in a way, you know, sometimes I tell people India is like here upside down. The it's so different. It's like being on another planet. And in general, there's a lot that was developed in the inner world, technologies for exploring inner universe and inner world, where in the West we emphasized, and the emphasis was the outer world and conquering the outer world. And what the world needs is a coming together of both, you know, to create balance. We're at a place in history where we need to take the good things from everywhere, and every place has different things to offer. And every place, you know, I spent 10 years traveling, and every place has its advantages and disadvantages, but we have a imbalance here of sort of being over materialistic and focused on the exterior, and due to a lack of having their exterior together, you know, can see the poverty and different things that occurred. So it's an amazing place. Some of the memories I have, once walking down the street in Calcutta, a city of more than 10 million, millions of people, and there's hundreds of thousands of people who are born and live their whole life and die on the streets. I mean, when you're walking down a downtown street, a lot of times you're stepping over people's bed rolls, and you know, you're literally kind of walking through their living room. And there was one time I walked down this one street, and there was a baby, an infant, lying in a puddle of diarrhea. And you look around, and there was no one there. Now, obviously, it must have been that a mother had had to go to the bathroom or something and put the child down. And, you know, there was nothing. It wouldn't have been. There was nothing I could do. You just, you know, you take these kind of things in. And that was an example of the shocking things you see. There are, you know, there's beggars. And I was in India back in the 80s, so things have changed, and I haven't been there for a long time. But, you know, there's moral dilemmas that Indian mothers have where, out of love for their child and knowing that they'll be able to beg for more money and get more food to feed their children, they sometimes will cut an arm or leg. You know, it's mind-boggling, the level of economic violence. And and with this rich ancient culture, you know, there's times, you know, there's so much ancient wisdom, but it's also, just like in any organized religion, whether it's the Catholic Church or the Hindus or whatever, there's things that get fossilized and become dogmas, and the way women are treated, and so many different things where, yeah, it's quite a contrast. And then when you're in India, it's like the food, you know, it's so varied and extreme and such intense colors and flavors. And so there's a it's so rich, and you're peeling away. To get to know a country like that, you peel away layers of the onion, and there's one layer after another. And you're constantly sinking in to a deeper understanding. So anyway, getting back to Arun Bhatti Roy's book, The Gods of Small Things, most of the other people were there, you know, found it shockingly depressing and stuff, but I was just so taken by the language, and she's such an amazing storyteller, and she's weaving all these different stories. And, yeah, it's, and she's an amazing author. She went on after writing that book, that kind of gave her a platform to be a spokesperson, and she's been a champion of the anti-globalization, the anti-multinational corporation movement, and speaking out about the harm of the concentration of wealth and the influence of World Bank and IMF. Quite an inspiring figure. And India, of course, has a very rich history of activism. The fight against the British was one of the things that they actually inspired the Irish to start fighting against the British. And so there's a real long historic movement there, and people know about Gandhi. And actually, Arundhati Roy, she's had the bravery. You know, Gandhi is canonized, and people don't realize it, just as there was Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in this country, similarly there was Gandhi and a person named Bose, Subhash Chandra Bose. And Bose led the Indian Liberation Army, and they were fighting to get the British out. And it was due to pressure coming from both sides that when the British were finally kind of forced out, they said, oh, well, we give it to Gandhi, and it's because of Gandhi, and they kind of rewrote history and left out the huge influence that Subhash Chandra Bose had. And Gandhi was so conservative that he was anti-technology. I mean, he felt that people should weave their own cloth and we shouldn't use factories and use technology at all. And so there's a lot people don't know about Gandhi. It's a much more complex picture. I'll give out the number here, call-in number 760-542-4345 if you want to join the conversation, if you have a question, comment. In India, you see these contrasts, like they have a rocket. And they'll have ox carts taking the rocket out to the launch pad. And there's just so many interesting images of contrast. But there was once when I went from Calcutta to Beverly Hills. I came back to the States and I actually had family in Santa Monica and Los Angeles. And so I remember I had just been in Calcutta and came back to the States and I was in Beverly Hills and looking at people's faces and seeing how much more frustration and anger there was on the faces of the people driving their Mercedes down the streets in Beverly Hills. The happiness and simplicity that people had in India. The strength of family and you know, you see children who lived and played on a wooden, on a dirt hut, but were full of joy and laughter and really puts things in a different perspective. And the lack of crime and fear. I would walk around Calcutta all times of day and night. And if there was that kind of income disparity here, I mean, you'd be mugged in 2 seconds. I always felt relatively safe. There's the things, India is so crowded, you're always kind of on guard for beggars and different swindles that happen. You have to know heavy wits about you in that sense. And actually, when I went to Nepal, being in between China and India, you get kind of both influences. And, such a beautiful place, Kathmandu and Nepal, and feeling that it's less crowded and, you know, Chinese are a lot more polite and, so you kind of get the best of both worlds there, near in that area in between China and India. Of course, there's the Tibetan culture up there, which is a very special place. And it's been part of the world drama as they have kind of lost their homeland and had to fight the Chinese. It's been the world gain that, I live here in Washington, D.C., and there's Tibetan temples here at the Tibetan spirituality has really gotten to spread throughout the world, partly due to the fact that Tibetans were forced out of their land. And the Indian perspective on things, there's the idea of that this creation is a dance, and they have a word Maya that this illusory nature that reality is always changing, so that this isn't the ultimate reality. So they're very aware of their connection to the eternal, the divine, the supreme, the everlasting part of this creation. And but the lila is the dance, and so God is dancing and we are dancing, and part of the practice of yoga and meditation is to align your will with God's will, with the lower self and the higher self, with a unit mind and the cosmic mind. There's an idea of if you drop a drop of water into the ocean, it becomes inseparable, becomes one with that ocean. And so that our mind is like a drop of consciousness that when it becomes part of infinite consciousness, when we expand our mind, it go back to the source, to our true nature, that that we experience a state of grace. Kripa is a Sanskrit word for grace. And it's said that we often wear the umbrella of our ego, which is blocking the grace that's showering down on us. And when you meditate and yoga means to become one, unity, to get yoked, hooked back up to that original oneness. Then you, they say do and get. So the do is doing the effort, the sadhana. It's a Sanskrit word for meditation, which just means the effort of doing your sitting practice, your meditation practice. And so it's always an exercise in strengthening your mind, increasing your ability to focus. Whatever you put your mind on, it takes that shape, it takes that energy, that vibration. If you allow yourself to have time in life where we're not just always engrossed in the outer world, we have time to reflect on our inner world and the nature of our soul and of who the I is. When we say, I am this and I am that, and I'm feeling this and I'm thinking that and I'm doing this. So when you get down to the core of who am I, and the I am is the being state, the pure being, get connected to that, then there's a expansion of mind and a opening of your heart, of your compassion, of your love of fellow creatures and nature and fellow travelers on this journey. Often when one looks out the window, it's said that life can be thought of as a train, and we're on this destination to return to our source. But we get so caught up in looking out the window of the train that we forget where we're going. We forget why we're on this journey. So that meditation is a way to reconnect to that, the deeper values and wisdom and understanding that you have inside yourself, returning to a calmer, centered place within you, more resourced place. And there's bhakti is devotion, Sanskrit word for devotion, which is a path of heart, which is said to be the easiest path. The intellectual path, if you are the type of person that likes to get multiple PhDs and likes reading 12 hours a day, or, there are certain people that are extremely intellectually oriented, but in general, you don't approach God through your head, it's through the heart. And so that's said to be the quickest and easiest path. You fall in love with something, someone, you're always focusing on them, you keep them dwelling on that. And so similarly, when you fall in love with the great, that which is without limit, without parallel, that which uplifts and expands and moves you out of your narrow focus, something larger, then you allow your mind and your heart to expand also, and you get into a flow. There's a flow that nature's in. Nature naturally is has its harmony, and that's why when we get to spend time in nature, we feel peaceful, and we reflect the beauty that we see in nature and feel that calmness and beauty inside ourselves. So also getting, aligning oneself with that universal flow, and it's a natural expression. Karma yoga, the path of action, is another path that's said to be more difficult than the path of devotion, but they all need to be. We need to develop ourselves physically, mentally, and spiritually again, to be healthy on all levels and to grow on all levels, and to be well-rounded is the calling. And so as you open your heart, you naturally want to help others who you see suffering, help the animal and plant kingdom, the world around us, which is like an expression of the universe. And so as that feeling of separation begins to lessen, and one will naturally seek to see how they can be an instrument of making this world a better place, that your footprint, we all have to take food and air and water and take up space, so hopefully we can leave something good and leave some legacy of that we did something worthwhile, we helped out others while we were here. And of course, part of karma is action and reaction, which is actually a physical law of physics. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So that's not just true on the physical level, it's also mentally, spiritually. And so we try to always be creating a more benevolent reaction. You're having actions that take in the welfare of others and seek to uplift and give support to those we come in contact with. And of course, I can get into a the spiral where those things interact and reinforce each other. So there's somebody in the call queue on mic. Sam, hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm just listening. Thank you.
Yeah, how are you doing tonight?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard your show before. Say again?
Oh, I just think this is the first time I've heard your show, so I like
yeah.
to acknowledge it. I learned a lot
about it. Did you have any question or comment or
No, I just started to listen, so I'm not really trying to just see what your top, you know.
Right.
Top.
Okay.
I know it's
so,
I'll just continue to listen.
Okay, so I'll just turn my mic for now. And, yeah, so there's, you know, people tend to spiral down or spiral up, and it's easier to walk down a staircase. It's actually easier to fall down and to have, let things go to unravel and, because it takes effort to build oneself up. To march, to move, to grow, takes, there's the word sacred in Greek, it comes from the word sacrifice, and there's, to make something sacred is to sacrifice, that there's a certain conscious effort, suffering that you're taking on. You sacrifice to that which has will have greater meaning to you, and then our lives become bigger than just the petty stuff that you know we're exposed to on television, and that they'd like everybody to be obsessed with all the petty trivia and media, celebrity nonsense and stuff. So it's when you get in touch with the deeper things and get a relationship with things that more you to what your mission is in life, to what gives you value, what you value, what you find meaningful, to what interests you, when you follow your interest, you follow your passion, you follow what inspires you, what draws you, and usually one finds that that's where one's gifts and one's place to develop, because it's a natural place that you want to focus, since you're interested in that. And as you learn more and grow in that, whatever it is that draws you into life, that it is that makes you feel full and satisfied and happy and gives you joy and allows you to give that joy out to the world. Then there's purpose. Meaning and purpose are very connected, and in the East they talk about Dharma, and Dharma means the innate nature. So it's the Dharma of water to pour down a hill, it's the Dharma of fire to burn up upward direction, and human dharma, we share dharma with animals because we evolved from animals. So animal dharma would be to sleep, to procreate, to eat, and feel fear. And we have these basic animal instincts and that are part of us and part of life and shouldn't be denied or even demonized or anything, but they're part of the natural thing, and we're natural animals ourselves, but we have the ability to self-reflect, and that's a real special choice of we can say determine where we put our mind, where we put the energies of our life. And if we choose to become conscious, that this is four main aspects of human dharma. There's the expansion, that the mind moves from a narrow state to a broader and broader state, and that's part of meditating and opening your heart and mind. And then there's dara is the Sanskrit word for expansion, and rasa is flow. So in the universe and nature, there's a certain flow. And when you can get parallelism between the universal flow and your flow, then you get this kind of support where things fall into place and you see signs, you have a certain synchronicity, and you see things reflected that give you a knowing and a support that all things are happening for a reason, and these things work out in a way that when they're difficult, there's lessons to be learned, there's things to look at ourselves in the mirror to try to become conscious of our shadow side and the things that we weren't conscious of, but learn and grow from the difficult things. Sometimes there's tests and there's different challenges, but usually when we look back, those are the places that we grew the most, and they helped us to become who we are. And then there's also that experience of grace, where you feel as if the universe is there supporting you, and you have a relationship. They talk about there's an impersonal aspect to the divine that's aware of the totality, and then there's a personal connection, and that's why often different spiritual traditions will have an embodied image of God, whether it's Buddha or Krishna or Shiva or Jesus, or, you know, it's easier to fall in love, to have a relationship with a guru, a human form, than just the abstract infinite mind, cosmic mind. So one has a feeling as if one's being guided and things are happening for a reason, and you know, that it makes sense, and that you will get the lessons you need to learn, and will get the resources when you need them, and you end up becoming an instrument, a vehicle for this universal flow there. And there's in dharma, then there's also service, seva. So it's a natural part of being human to want to help others, that this is, spirituality doesn't become a selfish pursuit. It's not just a self-absorbed thing one does in a cave in isolation. We become change agents. We become instruments of greater good in the world, and naturally when we see people hurting and suffering, we want to help them out. And then moksha, liberation, self-awareness, self-realization, unifying your lower and higher self, becoming whole, is another aspect of the human dharma. And it's a saying, if you protect dharma, dharma protects you. And that on this walk that we have, you start to feel the universal forces that you can align with, and in the East, they don't have a real sense of evil, that they consider evil a state of ignorance, that when one is in darkness, that there's no light can be seen, and therefore all kinds of, quote, evil actions happen due to the ignorance of that state, and that people who are abused, you know, usually get twisted into horrible states and often do horrible things. But those are people that didn't receive the proper love and nourishment and encouragement and having a proper environment for them to grow up in a good way and achieve some balance and wholeness. And as you, part of the meditation practice is keeping that flame in you and then reading something that's expansive, reading something that uplifts your mind, helps you to do your daily meditation practice and then doing service and helping with plants and the animals and this whole world, all the people in it, having an intention to, as you move through your day, to help those we see and help bring a smile to their face. And so part of this is one kindling one's own light and then helping light the lamps, the flames in others who we encounter in our day and in our journey in our life. And in Arundhati's book, I was talking at the beginning of the Gods of Small Things, she she takes a section of the Mahabharata and the stories we know, we love the most are the stories we know. And in India, everybody is entrenched in the epic that is one of the greatest epics of world literature, and the story of how there was a king, Arjuna, who got swindled out of his kingdom, and his wife was disgraced, and they were sent into exile for 10 years and had to live like beggars in the forest. And then the evil king who took over the kingdom had a very nasty rule, and people suffered. And so to write things, God incarnated in the form of Krishna, and he told the king, the prince, Arjuna, there were five brothers, and one of them was Arjuna. And Krishna said to Arjuna that, you know, you have to do your duty. You're in this human body. You can't choose not to act. And Arjuna was in conflict. He didn't want to, you know, this. He was related to these brothers who would, they were cousins who stole the kingdom from him. And, you know, it was unclear about what to do because he hated war and didn't want to see bloodshed and everything. And the metaphor they talked about is that, you know, life is a battle, and we have to struggle, and we can't not act. All we can just try to do is act with the most consciousness, with the most awareness, and with benevolent intention, and seeking the welfare of others, and so shrinking from the battle of life. So all metaphoric, as these epics are. So he says, you know, engage in that struggle, find out where there's darkness and try to bring some light to it. And Krishna ends up being his charioteer, and there's the epic battle. It's called the Mahabharata, and the Bhagavad Gita is just one section out of that larger epic. The Bhagavad Gita means the song of God, and it's actually Krishna's advice to Arjuna when he's confused and doesn't know what to do. And it's such a long, the entire epic of the Mahabharata, which is the great battle, takes volumes and volumes to tell, and there's different forms depending on how much detail one gets into. And yeah, so there's a nice retelling of some of that, some of the Mahabharata story in Arundhati Roy's book, The Gods of Small Things. And the stories and myths are teaching tools. There's something archetypal to these patterns that help us reflect, and it's often easier to learn stories, learn things through stories. And in India, they do a lot of storytelling as a way of teaching. There's a famous story of these two monks were coming to a river. They were going to cross, and there was a woman that came to the river at the same time, and she was unable to cross. So one of the monks picked her up and carried her across the river and put her down on the other side, and she thanked him that she was able to go on her way. And they parted, and like 3 days later, this other monk he was traveling with, you know, burst out in anger and said, "You know, that was wrong. You weren't supposed to touch women. That's against the vows. And why were you doing that?" And so the one monk who carried the woman said, "Carried her for a couple minutes, but for the last 3 days, you've been carrying her in your mind, thinking about this." And so in India, they talk a lot about the colors of the mind, that our mind gets colored by all the things we come in contact with. And they actually have a practice called puja, surrendering the colors of the mind. So Guru Puja is offering up the thoughts, the emotions. They go, often it's done 3 times, once for the physical, once for the mental, and once for the spiritual, offering all that up to God, to the divine, and say, you know, you take this, and I surrender. There's a surrender pose, is like offering. Often the hands are cupped, and one will offer those colors of the mind, and then one will prostrate, called Sastam Pranam, in a surrender pose. And there's an emptying and a giving out, and also in the Vedic astrology, the nodes of the moon are called, the south node is called Ketu, and the north node is called Rahu. So this Naga snake demon has his head cut off, and that's part of the story of how the nodes of the moon were created. So the head that floats without a body is restless and can't ground. And so when you look at a person's astrological chart, often there's where there's issues with addiction and being over focused and never satisfied and always ambitious and not achieving, and always this hungry ghost type of feeling. And where there's Ketu, which is symbolized by the body without the head, it's actually a very spiritual part of oneself. And part of the symbolism is you have to lose your head, lose your ego to get liberated, and the shadow side of two is feeling alienated from the world. I'm feeling I don't belong here. I want to stop the world. I want to get off being very detached. And in some cases, if it's badly aspected by Mars and different things, that creates fanaticism and fanatics, things like that. So we'll give out the number one last time here in case anybody is listening and wants to call in with a question or comment. Call in number 760-542-4345. And they say that meditation is like polishing the mirror. A mirror gets dust on it as we go through our life, and that to be able to reflect the light of the moon, the mirror needs to be polished, and that's the effort that comes in meditation. And the another image that's used is the lotus. The lotus flower blossoms. It's such a gorgeous white flower in the dark mud that it grows. So even though it's looking, it's growing in this cesspool of mud, it's looking up at the moon. It's looking, it keeps its thoughts elevated as part of the symbolism of the lotus. And So India has an extremely rich cultural heritage. Actually, India, the older tradition was Tantra, which Tantra means, mantra means to liberate the mind, and Tantra means to liberate oneself from dullness. And Dalai Lama is a tantric teacher. All of that northern India is tantric culture. Shiva was very much connected to tantric tradition. And in the West, it's become perverted to think that tantra is about sex and stuff. And just because they don't have a negative view about sex, they feel that you should have a balanced and healthy diet of food, you should have balanced and healthy sex life, you should have, you know, the physical body and should be healthy and balanced. And since our religion was kind of sex negative, viewing it as sin and something bad, it got very kind of blown out of proportion, Tantra in the West. And a lot of the Vedas and the yoga tradition is a lot about opening your heart, and the Tantra gives control. It's a very powerful and fast system with a lot of different meditation practices of pranayama, different breathing things and mantras, and purifying the chakras, working with your energy centers, your chakra system. And in the Vedic past, there's great wisdom in the Vedas. They often will talk, kind of a typical Vedic prayer is like, "Oh Lord, guide me to the path of light, to the path of self realization." And in the tantric path, it would be I am that supreme infinite source of being. I'm one with that. It's much more direct rather than asking to be guided towards it. It's a more direct and a very powerful. So it's usually done with a chair, and there's a lot involved. And we think of yoga as being something that you do in the gym and something that's done, you know, has to do with exercise. Yoga is about becoming one with the divine, becoming one with your true nature. And to do that, the mind is much more involved. It's mostly a meditation practice to get to that state of oneness. You need a physical, healthy physical body that's the vehicle that the mind resides in. And again, in the West, this whole gymnastics kind of spirituality of yoga developed and is not as much part of the original. In yoga, there's eight limbs, so Hatha yoga was one of the eight limbs, and most of the other limbs have to do with the meditation practice. And there's also jama niyama, certain ethical do's and don'ts and things, guidance for how to live a balanced life. And it's all part of this rich cultural tradition there that's there in India. So I'll go out with some Indian kirtan, B76054243455, in case there's somebody that had a question or comment. And otherwise, I'll say good night and thank you all for listening. And take care. Tune in next week. And this is some mantra meditation music that you can find great chanting, kirtan, and bhajan, and different meditation music at innersong.com. This is Randy Goldberg. My website is randygoldberg.org or astrodc.com, astrodc.com. I do astrology readings. I keep them affordable. It's $80 for an hour reading, and you'll get both the Western and the Indian big charts. And from a Jungian perspective, and I can do it by phone, by Skype. And so there's information at my website. So take care till next week.